Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Good morning, Rabbit.
Hey, good morning. This is Peter, otherwise known as the Rabbit. And, well, you came in loud there. I did a sound check on you, and you came in extra loud.
I got excited.
Is that what it was?
You're starting this wonderful show.
To be on. And what are we doing this week? We're going a little bit spicy this week.
A little spicy. And we're going to start, actually, with who knew that there were 660 potential curries, but here we have it.
And the Raghavan Iyer interview subject said that actually a lot more than that.
Yes.
He only contracted initially to do 1,000 and then finished up with 700 instead. But the story of how he did that and the story of how he developed the book and the story behind it
is
really fascinating. I'm sure you'll enjoy.
Raghavan Iyer, your name has a certain lilt to it. You're from Bombay. It's the same lilt that sort of runs through this amazing book called 660 Curries. How did you absolutely... Well, first, let's say that you have many hats, as you admit to, cooking and so forth. But you're, the heart of your whole personality is that you're a teacher. I mean, you want to teach. You want people to learn. Is that true?
That's very true, Anne.
And you could tell in this book.
Thank you. It was, when I wrote the book, this is my third book, but when I wrote this particular book on this topic, I wanted to write it as a cooking teacher talking. You know, having taught for 18 years, I always said the best thing I could do was to empower my students to make their own curries. And so when I set about writing the book, that's the voice I wanted to create.
Did that indeed.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
And the book is so appreciated because you have testimonials in the back here from, look at this, Lynn Rosetta Casper, who's a colleague of ours, and Matthew Jaffrey. We interviewed her once, didn't we?
We did, yes.
Yeah, she's at one of the Beard events when she was inducted into
the Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame, yeah.
I think it was the Cookbook Hall of Fame first book that had been through umpteen printings and was written like 25 years ago.
Yes. But they call this book nothing short of a treasure chest.
Well, thank you. I was very honored when that came through. And the book truly is a book that's one of its kind, that really gets into the in-depth world of Indian curries. And I think, you know, one of the main reasons I wanted to do it was to burst quite a few myths about the concept and also the misconception of the word curry itself. And
how would you define curry?
A curry to an Indian is a lot different than what it is to the rest of the world. The word curry to an Indian really has everything to do with sauces. And in a nutshell, if it doesn't have a sauce, it's not a curry. In fact, the word curry itself, as we speak it in the English language, is a word that's not spoken in any of the 23 languages in India.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, we have words that sound similar to curries. You know, words like kari, kadhi, tadhi, tari. These are all words for dishes that have a sauce or a gravy to it. And, in fact, there are many curries in India that actually don't have spices in it, but just fresh herbs.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, again, I always say think sauce. And when it comes to the world of Indian curries, I say associate the four S's with it. They're saucy, they're spicy, they're simple, they're sensational.
Wow.
And
add another one there, because I never knew until this book that they're also seasonal.
You're right. See, and I think you've hit the nail on the head with the whole concept of the seasonality of ingredients. Is, you know, this is a country that is 6,000 years old, and they have always walked the talk of seasonal and local. And to this day, you know, especially a country that has over 150 varieties of mangoes, for instance, there are certain times of the years we get mangoes, and we use that in all its glory for a few short months, and we're done with it, and we move on to the next vegetable or produce or legume, and that's what makes it so interestingly timely, I guess, in so many ways.
So to just summarize your thought there, the idea, the misconception is that curry must be spicy.
Yep, and it's not, and... to me, spicy is well-seasoned. Spicy is not hot. Hot, to me, is a separate taste element altogether. But when I talk about spicy, I talk about vibrant. I talk about well-seasoned. I talk about assertive. I talk about mellow, and it sort of all gets qualified by a very simple word, which is balance.
Oh, yes.
And in the world of curries, we actually are balancing many things, everything from color, aroma, texture, temperature, to all the various taste elements. And that's why, you know, when you look at the whole concept from that standpoint, your vocabulary starts to change and you realize it's really not that difficult to do 660 curries. Foolish, but not difficult.
Yeah, I was going to say, why 660?
The original proposal was actually 1,001.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, and workmen, as you know, they do primarily big books and important books. And so even for them, you know, they said, well, that's a lot of curries. Why don't you give us between 600 and 800? And we wanted to keep it under 1,000 pages, and because the whole purpose was to make it accessible. And so I gave them a total of 701 recipes, off which 660 were curries and 41 were accompaniments, which
yeah,
I really have them cohorts.
Biryanis, breads, pickles, relishes, raitas,
okay.
And more.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
It's a lot of curries, but then India is a very large country with a lot of people. Is one of the reasons there's so much variety because curries vary regionally, am I on the wrong track there?
You're actually very much on the right track. Country that is one third the size of the United States and with a population of over a billion, it's no surprise the versatility from region to region. I mean, even within a certain region, if you look at the northern region or the southern region, and if you've got, you know, half a dozen states in those areas, every state, every area in that state has a difference and a versatility in their style of cooking. The spices they use are different, the way they use it are different, the local ingredients that are available are different, and so all of that goes into shaping the whole concept of regionality of Indian curry.
Now, did you research the traditions and how they varied, or did you just simply reflect the fact that you knew about them or you found out about them?
I researched. I spent about 6 to 8 weeks traveling extensively in India. And also then when I came back here, too, I also put together a lot of on-site visits and interviews with people from various parts of the subcontinent, from Pakistan, from Nepal, from Sri Lanka, went into their home kitchens and, you know, cooked with them and saw what they were doing and then sort of took some of that and incorporated it into recipes from those areas. So the book is very, very wide-reaching and truly reflects the flavors of the subcontinent.
No, it's like an encyclopedia, if you like. It's a primer on how to approach the whole subject of curry, but how do you think people would use it as a cookbook?
It's actually very user-friendly, and the book, the way it's laid out, you know, the first couple of chapters are very, it gives you some background, some information, some introduction to the elements of curries. It also walks the reader through the myriad of herbs and spices, and there's different blends and pastes, and there are boxes that talk about, you know, here are the top five blends you could put together. And incidentally, each of those blends and pastes will take you less than 5 minutes to do from start to finish. And then, you know, once they sort of get going, I always say open the refrigerator, you know. If you feel like eating chicken today or shrimp or wild salmon, that's what you've got. And you can actually go to that chapter, and all those recipes are grouped together by type. And you can go through and see, oh, this looks interesting, or I've got all of these, and I may have to go to the store for a minimal number of additional ingredients. And then that's how they're also building the pantry a little at a time. I always say don't run to the store and get every ingredient that I'm asking for, because that's what can be daunting. But eventually, you know, you're going to build your pantry a little at a time, and then you'll start to realize that you may have spent 5 minutes in putting together a blend, but that's not the only recipe you're going to use it for. There plenty of other recipes in the book that'll call for that. So,
now, would you need to have an Indian market, like there's one here called the Bombay market, which is where we buy the ingredients from that region that we want? Is it typically that kind of place you're going to have to be able to find?
It's certainly some of the more harder to find ingredients. Yes, you will have to go to an Indian grocery store. But these days, you know, I mean, you've got so many options. If you even live close enough to a fairly mid-sized city, more often than not, there's an Indian grocery store there. In the back of the book, I give you a list of mail order sources.
Okay, so that's another way to go as well, but that's not quite as spontaneous.
No, but on the other hand, I mean, you can, with these mail order sources, you could have your groceries delivered to you the next day. So it's not, I've always said nowadays, you know, there's no excuse not to cook Indian anymore. And,
well, people have to know what to look for. I mean, the majority of Indian restaurants in the United States, is what most people would be exposed to, are northern.
Yes.
And they have these menus where you have to order the dish according to a number on the, what do you call that, the heat scale.
On the menu,
I mean, that's what people, in fact, until recently, London was like that, too. In fact, I've heard people say that the curry places, the Indian restaurants in London, are English-Indian.
Yes.
Anglo-Indian restaurants. But now we're getting new, more fashionable, upscale, and probably more authentic and more contemporary Indian restaurants in both places, right?
Absolutely. And you're seeing that same wave come into the United States. And in fact, and it's funny you mentioning restaurants, I just was hired as a consulting executive chef for an upscale contemporary Indian restaurant that's opening in downtown Minneapolis.
Really?
Yeah, it's a restaurant called Om, as in, you know, the state of Nirvana,
right.
O-M. And that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm showcasing the culinary landscape that is regional Indian cooking, but presenting it in a contemporary package, recognizable elements, but the flavors are very classic. The combinations are classic. Because to me, you know, Indian home cooking is one of the best. Why not showcase that? And I think people are becoming more and more aware, and they're more receptive to trying some of these exciting tastes.
Now, your section called Contemporary Curries, these are your modernization of
the traditional. These are my creations based on classic combinations and flavors. I mean, you take wild salmon, to give an example, which is not obviously native to India, but it's fish that is prized in this country, especially. I'm a big fan of sustainable seafood. I was just named a sustainable seafood ambassador for the Monterey Bay Aquarium.
Oh, that's good news, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, because I really do believe that you have to be conscious of what it is that you're using. And
I hope we're not too late into the game, because
I hope not.
Things
either,
are getting wiped out.
They are, and they have the aquarium has a fantastic program called the Seafood Watch Program.
Right, yeah, we're well familiar with that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually, you know,
I wish more chefs paid attention to
it. I really do, and, you know, when I'm planning the menu for this new restaurant, I'm basing the seafood and fish items based on their Seafood Watch Program. So wild salmon from the Pacific Northwest and from Alaska is what they recommend, and if you take that, rub that with a little bit of turmeric, sear that in canola oil, and then you can poach it with a sauce done with coconut milk that's redolent with malt vinegar, chilies, garlic, ginger, and cinnamon.
Ooh, yums.
and you created in that little pan, you created an amazing layered complexity that sings in your mouth. And I think to me that typifies classic flavors, but a contemporary presentation.
I think we're going to have salmon a little differently the next time we have it.
Yeah, I think so.
sounds like fun.
We know we have scallops for tonight. Do you have a recipe for scallops in here?
I do have a scallop recipe. It's scallops that's, again, it's seared, and then there's a really fantastic combination of spices that's put together from the western region of India, and it's called Kolhapuri Masala, which incorporates dried coconut, red chilies, and white sesame seeds, and some other common spices, and they're toasted and ground. And then when the scallops are seared, I also take a lot of fresh spinach and cook the spinach with the scallops, and there's a little bit of that spice blend that's added towards the end, and crushed peanuts round out the whole experience.
Well, you don't miss a beat in that one. You have everything good in there.
Right. Well, I'm not planning to go back to the store today, so I think we'll have to think about that for the next time. But I might get some rubbing spice ideas from that recipe anyway.
Uh-huh.
So anyhow, listeners, this is 660 curries. And you can find it on our website. And the author, teacher author, is Raghavan Iyer. And you're going to just drool over this whole cookbook if you get a hold of it. You'll be cooking and cooking and cooking.
Well, I'd really appreciate you too.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you. You're delightful.
Likewise. Yeah, likewise. And I hope to get a chance to chat with you again soon.
That'll be fun, and we're going to do some more experimenting. I'm looking forward to it already.
Great. Sounds good. Look forward to hearing back.
Raghavan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we're going to take a break now, but we're going to continue this subject on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu. Remember to email us anytime and all the time on the menu at onthemenuradio.com or check out our blog, which is onthemenuradio.blogspot.com, or there's Ann Haig on Twitter, or OTM Dish. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm on Facebook, I'm Ann Haig.
Oh, you are? Okay.
On Twitter, I'm OTM Dish. And I'm losing track of all this socializing.
She's all over the place.
But, yeah, sure
but,
I am.
We're back on track.
Yeah, and what I meant about we're going to continue this is that we're going to continue a discussion of spices, but from a slightly different point of view, another approach. Now, Iyer's approach is, or Iyer's approach is actually tradition. And now we have Monica Bidet, who is more, well, you could listen to what I say, she's more a modern spice girl.
Monica Bidet, welcome to On the Menu. We've certainly enjoyed your book called Modern Spice. Could you explain, well, first of all, let's talk a little bit about your background. You were born in India. And grew up in the Middle East. You were born in New Delhi, to be specific. And then you came in the 90s, I understand, to the U.S., and you live in Washington. Is that correct?
That is correct. First of all, thank you very much for having me on your show. This is very exciting.
Oh, well, I'm excited, too. I'm excited about the book. I might even tackle these recipes because it wouldn't take me 3 days to get the ingredients.
You know, I'm actually an engineer by profession, and I came to the States, I think it was around 1991, to get my master's degree from GW. That's George Washington University here in D.C.
Right.
And I worked for a long time in corporate America, almost 13 years. I was with Ernst & Young and then Hewitt Associates, and decided about 5 years ago that that's not really what I had intended to do with my life, and what I really, really wanted to do was write. I wanted to be a writer. And there's, you know, they always say you should write about what you love, and so I started with food and parenting and travel, and all of it, I think, culminated in this book, Modern Spice, which is all about, you know, how to cook for your family without sacrificing any flavor. But being able to do it in 20 minutes so that, you know, your kids are not pointing out the window and going, where's McDonald's?
Very good.
Now, do they have McDonald's in India?
They do have McDonald's in India.
Oh, sure they do. That's
very good choices on the menu, too.
Okay. It's funny. Your story is a little bit like Madhur Jaffrey. Do you know her?
I do not know her personally, but I absolutely know who she is.
Yeah, oh, she's amazing.
When she spoke to her, she said she came to the U.S. to be a movie star.
Well, she was an actress.
And then she discovered that she wasn't quite going to make that, so she became a cookbook author and a chef instead. So your story is very similar to that. It's a natural progression from being raised in India to working for Ernst & Young to becoming a cookbook author. Everybody does it that way around.
Well, it was really funny. I remember the first day that I quit my job, and I woke up. It was a Monday morning. I'll never forget. And I looked at my husband and I said, okay, so I want to be a writer. What do I do? And I mean, it literally was saying, like, I want to be a Hollywood celebrity. What do I do? There's no path defined.
No, it's not easy. It's very hard to get published. It's very hard to get paid for publishing. But, I mean, you've done very well. I mean, you're very well respected on the basis of your food and your writing. I mean, your writing is... It's just fluent. It just flows. Well, we're going to get to this idea that how you modernized Indian cooking, but I wanted to get out front here how you fit your essays. I mean, how do they fit into this as a book?
Well, it's interesting. You know, a few weeks ago I was talking to somebody who said, how would you describe modern spice? If you had one word, how would you describe it? And I thought, it's all about memory. Food always brings back memory for people. Whether it, you know, you think about the first cup of coffee that you smell in the morning, what it reminds you of, or you taste a mushroom somewhere, it may remind you of your grandmother's kitchen. Always brings back memories. And I couldn't do justice to this book without incorporating memories in it, without telling people, you know, how these recipes came to be the way they are, how people influenced me, the people that I've met along the way. And also, many times, food memories aren't really about the food itself. You know, they're about the people who are connected with the food. Watching my friend make these wonderful meals and have her constantly tell me that she wasn't a real cook because she wasn't a gourmet cook.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're just wonderful memories that I think are so much a part of my life that I felt the book would be incomplete without them.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the whole history of what of the really successful and moving and long-lasting food writers. I mean, you have from Elizabeth David and you have MFK Fisher. I mean, this is what it's about.
I think so, and I, you know, a lot of people will write to me, and I think that's the biggest compliment that I can get when they write to me and say, I was really intimidated by Indian food, but I tried the recipe because I liked your story.
Uh-huh. Now that's success. That's great.
Now, how would you say you convinced yourself that you could be expert enough about modern applications of Indian cooking to write a book?
I think, first of all, I cook a lot. I teach a lot of cooking classes. I've traveled around the world and met various Indian chefs. And I felt like the way that I'm seeing Indian cuisine progressing is towards this trend of modernization. Not because people don't like tradition or don't respect where they came from or anything like that. I think we are given the honor of modernizing because we respect tradition. You know, because I grew up understanding spices and the way they work, I feel like I have the freedom to play with them, to see, you know, how can I bring out the best flavor without having the help of a servant in the kitchen like many of my relatives.
Well, this is true, yeah.
You know, because they make very authentic, wonderful food, but then when you go in the kitchen, there's three servants helping to grind the spices, to, you know, chop the onions and to make the chutneys. It's wonderful, but I don't have that here.
Yeah.
There you go. Now, we talked in our last interview about the very successful Indian chef in London called Vineet Bhatia.
Vineet Bhatia, yes.
You know him too?
I do not know him personally, but I don't know who he is. Yes.
Apparently, he's doing some very radical and modern things.
Urban
with Indian food. Well, no, but in his restaurant called, I think it's Rasoi.
Correct. Rasoi Kitchen.
He's doing some really dramatically different things.
He's very successful, too, very popular.
I think it's about, you know, it's one of those things where it's an idea whose time has come.
Right.
You know, people for so long in the U.S. and in other places have been eating very traditional Indian food and have started to enjoy it and have started to respect the flavors. And I think people are ready for a little bit more. It's like, what's next? And I strongly believe it's not always about following trends. It's about creating trends. I see something new. I see something different. And I want to tell you about it.
Can you give us a couple of examples? In the last interview, we talked about salmon, which is not in the Indian larder at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the 660 curry chef said, no, I think it fits and I have some great recipes for it. Do you have examples like that in your book?
Absolutely. In fact, we'll start with the salmon, which I think really takes well to spices because it's a very robust fish and the spices work wonderfully in it. There's a recipe in my book which actually takes a chutney, puree the chutney and use it as a marinade for salmon.
Huh.
I mean, it couldn't get simpler than that, but yet the taste, I mean, when you taste it, you're like, I mean, I really didn't do any work to create this recipe. Is it really that easy? You know, I like that feeling.
Well, did you sort of think about it, or you just were recording what you actually started doing with your lifestyle?
I think it was a little bit of both. Most of it was just the way that I cook every day.
Okay.
And, you know, when I sat down with the book, to write the book, one thing that occurred to me, and this is reflected in the book a lot, I think, is that, you know, I have access to a lot of spices.
Mm-hmm.
But when people are cooking from this book, I didn't want them to cook one dish with, say, cumin, and then say, okay, she has no other recipes for the spice that I just bought.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I tried to use the
same
spices.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I shouldn't even admit this, but I remember about 15 years ago, I bought large containers of curry spices, cumin, mm-hmm. a coriander, what else did I have?
Right.
And anyhow, they got pushed to the back of the cabinet for some reason.
You just threw them out.
I just threw them out 15 years into it.
You are making some kind of spice shrimp dish.
It was curry shrimp.
For a certain person's 50th birthday party.
Yeah.
Which was almost exactly 17 years ago.
Oh, wonderful.
But they were really large containers.
Yeah. And was just going through the cupboard. I was away for a few days, so she got this clean the house binge going on. So she threw out all these 17-year-old spices. I felt sure they had a few more years left in them.
Yeah, right.
Like the jar of carrot pickle that gets pushed to the back of the refrigerator.
Yeah, that never dies.
It must be.
You're absolutely right. I see that in my cooking classes all the time. People drag in roller bags of spices that they bought from the big discount stores.
Yeah, that's it.
And they're like, what do I do with these? So that was the thought that went in. For instance, one of my favorite things in the whole world is tamarind chutney. And
mm-hmm.
you can buy the chutney. It's very easily accessible. And then I thought, you know, it's not just for dipping. Let me show them four different ways to use the chutney. You can use it to create a tamarind margarita. You can use it to create tamarind honey shrimp. You can do so many things with
tamarinds it. Tamarinds are wonderful. We have a cousin that grows them in Australia.
Well, it's wonderful. You know, that way the tamarind chutney doesn't get pushed back to the back
right.
of your pantry, only never to be seen again.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I get the carrot pickle out all the time. It just, Anne says it can't possibly be spoiled by it. It can't possibly be good now.
It's hot.
Why would this hot carrot pickle ever spoil?
No, that's true. That's true.
Now, you also have hung around with a number of influential people. I mean, influential in the sense that they've influenced you. I'm reading about our friend Jose Andres here. It says, this recipe is what happens when people hang around, right?
Yes.
And with Western people. And this is shrimp a la Jose with coconut dipping sauce. And you have a story that goes with that.
I do. I mean, I love hanging around. I'm sorry. I'm being very casual. You know, I've interviewed so many chefs and so many people along the way. But there are some people that just really become part of your DNA.
Uh-huh.
And you really don't know why that happens when you first meet them. And then you go on and you learn from them. And you see why they were meant to be part of your life. I love him because he always shows me what it means to be in love with your ingredients. I've seen him cook, and I've seen the way he looks at ingredients. People look with that much love at their wife. You know what I mean? He's wonderful, and he taught me what it means to respect your culture and respect your traditions and respect where you came from. And I think he taught me how to be free and how to play around with my spices. He has been a wonderful friend and a great supporter. And honestly, that's a huge honor because look at who he is and look at his level of knowledge.
Now,
you know, if I can learn anything from him, I consider myself lucky.
I'm looking upside down at called The Legendary Chicken 65.
Yes.
Come on, explain that one. It sounds like an interstate number.
Well, you know, my friends... we're teasing. I hope there's not too many little children listening to the show, but my friends were asking me if it was really Chicken 69 and if I made it Chicken 65 since it was going in, you know, a cookbook that kids may look at. But Chicken 65 has a very funny history where nobody exactly knows where that name came from. It's a deep-fried chicken dish that's found on many bar menus around India.
I see.
And everybody says, where did it get this name? Nobody knows. Somebody says, well, there were 65 spices in it. It was at the 65th train stop or bus stop for somebody. But I had to include it because it's such a delicious dish. It's not very hard to make. And, you know, always makes a good conversation story at your dinner table about, really, let's decide on another theory of where the 65 came from.
Now, you go back and forth to India?
I do. I try to go almost every year.
Well, tell me this, though. I'm sure that the traditions are maintained in the home. What about the restaurants? Do you see modernization and contemporary in what you find in restaurant food today in India?
Actually, if I may go back to your question just a little bit where you said it's maintained at home, I think things are changing.
Okay.
4 years ago...
Yeah, I wasn't sure that was right when I said it, actually.
No, it's changing. You know, 4 years ago, three or four years ago, I did a story for the New York Times for their food section about how Indian eating habits at home and in restaurants were changing as money was coming into the Indian economy.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I remember... For part of the interview, I interviewed this one woman who was having a big argument with her mother-in-law because she was buying ready-made yogurt. And her mother-in-law was terribly upset, you know, because we've always made yogurt at home. Why do you need to buy it? I just don't understand.
Uh-huh.
And the way people are cooking and thinking about food and everything, in the modern cities, it's changing. You know, it's different in the villages, of course, but it's changing in the cities. Definitely in the restaurants, it's changing. You can get... I mean, the variety of food available in India today is mind-boggling.
In what way? I mean, different cuisines.
Like in Bombay, there's a restaurant in one of the hotels, and I think it's owned by Morimoto, the chef, where they fly in fresh fish from Japan every day to make the sushi.
Wow.
I mean, it's some of the best food that I've ever had in the world is available in Bombay and Delhi. Things are really changing. There's more money coming in. The middle class is able to spend more. They like to go out more. The tastes are becoming very global. It's amazing when I go in, people will ask me questions, and sometimes I feel so ignorant because their level of food knowledge, their thirst for knowledge of food is unbelievable.
Amazing. That's good to know, actually.
It's a wonderful thing. I mean, I think it's really... You know, I was at the headquarters for a major U.S. Computer company in Bangalore interviewing the kids who worked at the call centers there just about how food was changing and, you know, how their eating habits were changing. Their cafeteria was unbelievable. They were serving Thai, Indian, Chinese, you know, continental breakfasts, lunch, fresh squeezed juices. I mean, none of this existed when I was there.
Right. Amazing. Now, in terms of, talked a little bit about Indian restaurants, where do you go, for example, in D.C.?
Two of my favorite Indian restaurants in D.C. The first one is Rasika.
Okay.
Rasika actually in Sanskrit means flavors. Rasika does very modern Indian food. They have a fabulous chef who flew in from London here who opened the restaurant with the owner, Ashok Bajaj. Fabulous, fabulous food. And the second one is Indique Height. They do southern Indian food, and they've really brought out the flavors of South India with things like a Syrian chicken on the menu. And they have chicken chettinan, which is a very spicy chicken with curry leaves, but it's served in a very modern way. And I think those two restaurants are really defining what it means for the cuisine to be changing.
How about New York?
Well, I haven't been to New York in a while, so I can't really comment, but I think Tabla is
I was going to say, yeah.
Best fusion restaurants
ever. Do you think Floyd is in this modern mode?
I think Floyd is definitely in the modern mode.
And yeah, I love him. Absolutely love him.
Yeah, he's one of the leaders, I think, in the modern
mode. Yeah, he just opened a little cafe adjacent. Yeah. So, anyhow, I'm anxious to try that. We could chat forever, Monica. You have so much information here.
Okay, thank you very much. We're done now with you.
Yeah, well. We have this book already up on our website, by the way. Listeners, it's called Modern Spice. And this gives you a whole different perspective on what it takes to prepare really flavorful Indian food in your home. And I'd jump at the chance to sample the taste of India in a doable, accessible way. Monica, you're a delight. Would you keep us posted on your next book? You're working on another one?
Absolutely. I will keep you posted. I have several ideas in my head about what I want to do next. And one of them actually is perhaps learning a little bit of the history of alcohol in India because...
Oh, yeah, what about that? That's interesting.
Yeah, there's a lot of it, and people don't... you know, the general impression is that all Indians are vegetarian and they don't drink, and that's not true.
Yeah.
There's so much depth and breadth of food and drink in India. I think it's worth exploring.
Well, we'll look forward to you coming back on the program
your next book.
When that happens. And perhaps if we're down your way, we'll be able to go together to one of these restaurants that you so much enjoy, and you can tell us what we should eat.
It would be my pleasure anytime. And thank you for having me on your show.
Yeah, and I'm delighting here. I always get sidetracked into reading your little essays. I mean, this one about the popcorn. Oh, well, we'll leave that to another discussion. Monica, thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Okay,
bye-bye. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You were very clever there, sweetheart, talking about Monica Bidet as a modern Spice Girl. I don't know if that's what you meant. We were not talking about her musical ability. And of course, you understand what great culinary ability she now has as a result of hearing the interview. But now it's time to
take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again. I guess we have to make a decision at this point. We have three more interviews, and they're totally unrelated and all good. Should we just run them all, or take a break after each one?
We're going to take a break after the next one, I think.
Okay. Because I love this.
It's sort of on theme because it's not spicy, but it goes with spicy. And what goes with spicy? But noodles.
Noodles.
And this is a wonderful noodle cookbook. By a real expert on noodles. His first name is Takashi, and his last name is. Oh, she can't even read it. Oh, no, it's because it's not down here on the sheet of paper. But you'll hear who it is at the beginning of the interview anyway.
Well, I think that if the saying is correct, that one eats with his or her eyes, then I have devoured a whole bunch of noodles. I want to welcome Takashi Yagihashi from his namesake restaurant in Chicago to On the Menu. Hello, Takashi.
Hello. Hi, how are you?
What a wonderful book this is.
Oh, thank you so much.
Now, you were born and raised in Japan, right?
Right, that's correct.
And the book is just so gorgeous, as I said. We'll get into that later. But what is it about noodles that are so important to the Japanese?
You know, exactly you just say that's very important to, you know, all the Japanese people, especially when I was grown up and 5-6 years old until teenager, after the teenager, noodle is very, very connected with all the Japanese people's life. And because, you know, noodle is very easy to get and easy to eat and easy to get out. Kind of American people like a hamburger or a hot dog.
Uh-huh.
So, and very inexpensive, too.
So it's the ultimate comfort food.
Exactly.
Now, how did you get, you started cooking in Japan,
uh-huh.
but you've been in this country for quite a long time.
Right.
And one of your hallmarks is that you are French trained as well.
Exactly. Uh-huh.
So explain how you got from Japan to Chicago.
Well, I started cooking when I was 16 in Japan. Then I moved to Tokyo. And I went to the design school. I learned that I studied the PR design.
Did you really?
Yeah. And in the meantime, I still need some money. So after the school, I went to the restaurant to make some money for supporting myself.
Mm-hmm.
So then, that time, I heard of it. My owner chef's friends, they're looking for the help in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I jump on at these things, and
I
asked my owner, hey, please introduce your friends. I want to go to the United States because always I'm very curious about American life.
Uh-huh.
So that's why, you know, I begged my chef, then send me here, and I helped there opening a Japanese restaurant and a couple of restaurants in the west suburb of the Chicago.
Huh.
Then somehow I changed my career, Japanese cooking, to French food. Then I'm still here.
But you're applying your French techniques to traditional Japanese ingredients, updated, though.
Yes, I'm very...
You're very modern with this.
Yeah, and, it's, you know, my kitchen is pretty much French organized, kind of. We do have a sauté stations, garde manger, and, you know, grill, that kind of thing.
Now,
I organized it very French way. But
how did you learn that, Takashi?
It's coming from very natural way because I worked in different French restaurants and
Oh, okay. So you learned it in French kitchens, in French-style kitchens.
Exactly.
There's an interesting restaurant in Paris. I don't know if you've heard of it, called Hiramatsu.
Oh, yeah. Hiramatsu is the top chef.
The Hiramatsu restaurant in Paris apparently got a Michelin star faster than any restaurant ever had before.
Yeah, that's a little bit.
But it's a Japanese chef cooking French food in a French restaurant with a Japanese name in Paris.
Right.
It was funny, yeah.
Yeah, some Japanese chef wanted to be a French chef more than French people.
Oh, yeah. Well, now, this book, now you said you're a designer. Did you help pick the design elements for this book?
Unfortunately not, because, you know, it was already so many years ago. Mm-hmm. And I realized that some people are much more better than I do.
Oh, I'll tell you, the way you use this, the motif of the bunches of dried noodles is just so impressive.
Oh, thank you.
I'm not sure that you go through in this book every kind of noodle.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, I guess I was aware of these different kinds of noodles, but you do things to them that I've never seen anyplace else. I mean, how you, the actual recipes.
You know, actually, the recipe is, I started it. We do have so many different noodles, like udon noodle, ramen noodle, soba noodles, and somen. I'm going to keep that some traditional, authentic cooking. Then, plus, I add to the my experience and my background. I'm living in Chicago now.
Uh-huh.
So I thought it would be nice things to have. If you buy this cookbook, you can learn fundamental traditional Japanese cooking. Then you can, you know, get something my way to cooking because I'm living in the United States.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so you can kind of get a variety of style of the...
Well, I mean, who would expect somen in a clay pot with chicken and eggplant?
Uh-huh.
Now, what is traditional about that, and what is your twist on it?
That's the, somen in the clay pot with the eggplant, right?
With chicken and eggplant.
Right. That one is a little bit of, you know, sometimes we use for the duck instead of the chickens.
Uh-huh. That would make more sense.
Yeah, winter times, and, you know, we use the lots of clay pot.
Right.
And if you cook it there and keep it, you know, temperature very even and soft, kind of heating up. So we do that all the time in the winter time. Individually, you're gonna cook it with individually clay pot, and it's very hearty and keep it your body is warm and so great.
And you do something else that is not typically Japanese. Is that you? Although you said that it is now popular in Japan, you do Southeast Asian noodles.
Right. And we use that the rice noodle there. And the
you even use pasta. You make Japanese spaghetti.
Exactly. It's kind of weird, but in Japan, probably 20 years ago, and Italian pasta is getting so popular, then a lot of chefs is creating that their own way. So I introduced that to my cookbook. Some, you know, pasta is very unique things in Japanese, you know, spaghetti, kind of very Japanese ingredients. For example, we do that pollock roll.
Uh-huh.
And it's, you know, you can buy it in Japan. We call the mentaiko. That's a spicy pollock roll. Then you're going to cook with the spaghetti and finish with the little bit over leaves. And that's very, you know, Italian people doesn't do that way.
No, they don't. And you also introduce Korean dishes into this
right.
book.
Yeah, it's the Korean cooking in Japan is so popular.
Well, you know, I really have, every year they predict trends.
Uh-huh.
And for the last couple of years, it's always been that the hot trend is going to be Korean style
mm-hmm.
cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting. You know, I might add here, in case people don't really know you, that you were so into award-winning, you were named Best Chef Midwest by the James Beard Foundation. You were one of the 10 best new chefs by Food and Wine magazine. Your restaurant is a year old, opened in 2008.
Right.
You have the testimonials by chefs on the back cover. It ranges from Ming Tsai through Susor, Daniel Boulou,
uh-huh.
Charlie Trotter, and Eric Repair, and they're all raving about your food.
Thank you.
Why do you think you have such a knockout following here?
We do cook together so many different events, and, also that they come to my restaurant and serve the food to them. And I just try to keep the something I'm cooking style is very unique to them, probably. Because
uh-huh.
I want to keep the some contemporary French cooking, then adding seasonal and lots of Japanese ingredients.
So when we come to your restaurant, what can we expect to find on the menu?
From my cookbook, you can find that seared main scallops with the soba. Gnocchi. That's the soba, is the buckwheat.
Yes.
And we make from scratch here.
Then, I love soba.
Yeah. And I finish with a little bit of celery root foam. That's like a bubbly, very fluffy sauce we're going to put in the top of it.
Oh, wow.
That's very one of the most popular dish in my restaurant.
Oh, you're making me so hungry. how about saying a word to you? Have relatives still in Japan?
I'm sorry, again?
Do you have relatives in Japan?
Yeah, I do have my mother.
Well, send her a message. Go ahead.
お母さん 元気 ですか? また帰りますんで。会いたいですね。よろしくお願いします。My mother to message.
Uh-huh. Well, that's great. So I hope that you tell her when to listen. We will let you know.
Uh-huh.
And then I hope that your mother listens, too.
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to eventually getting to try your restaurant because I'm really inspired by your cookbook.
And thank you.
It's wonderful to finally get to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Nice talking to you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll pause at this point once again.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, welcome back. Of course, we haven't left the theme of fine food and cooking behind in our next segments. In fact, one of them you could say is very related because it's a really very exciting magazine and a wonderful lady called Laura Buckle who publishes it, and it's called Fine Cooking Fresh.
Well, that's the name of the book she wrote.
Oh, that's the name of the book. Okay.
Yeah, the Fine Cooking is the magazine.
It's a magazine, okay. So you can
It's great.
So you can get a book and you can get a monthly dose as well. And then to finish up the program, and in honor of the reemergence of the spring, at least in on the menu's home turf, a tool that all outdoor accomplished outdoor barbecue chefs shouldn't be without, a wonderful thing called a Grill Daddy, and Michael Wales, the inventor of the Grill Daddy, is going to explain how it works and why you should have one. So that's how we'll conclude the program.
Laurie Buckle is editor of a really wonderful magazine called Fine Cooking, which has recently undergone a redesign, which we'll talk about a little bit later. We wanted to welcome Laurie to On the Menu, and particularly wanted to congratulate her on this wonderful cookbook, Fine Cooking Fresh, 350 recipes that celebrate the seasons. So tell us about what's going on in your life and with your book and everything, Laurie.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for having me. This is an exciting book, I think, as much because it's about spring, and spring is... It's just here on the horizon here. I'm really looking forward to kind of changing the way we cook.
And you were telling us that you moved from Los Angeles to Connecticut, huh?
I did. Yes, I made the big coastal shift, although I do still find myself in L.A. quite a bit, too.
Uh-huh.
I did have my first winter, though. I think the first winter ever.
Well, that was... How'd
you like that one?
I was told that it was the coldest winter in 24 years, so you can imagine I'm... still recovering.
Oh, no.
but you probably ate a lot of winter recipes while you were doing that, right?
I did. It was a really good excuse to get into the kitchen and, you know, cook warm food, definitely.
So what is some of the things? Let's start with
what makes this different from all the other...
Well, very well.
All the other cookbooks that are about seasonal cooking.
I won't bother to say anything.
Well, for me, this book, it's sort of the breadth and depth of it. I mean, very few cookbooks, I think, at this point out there right now have this many recipes, 350 recipes. So really, there is something here for everyone. You know, if you're in the mood for pasta, if you're in the mood for fish, if you want a great main course salad, it's going to kind of take you where your mood goes and the ingredients that you have on hand, too. I think with the seasons, you know, I have learned that it really does shift from coast to coast and north to south across the country. So if peas are in season in California, that's going to be a different time period out here. So I think it's, you know, that variety and that number of recipes really enables you to cook with that thing that's at your farmer's market right now.
I mean, the recipes are gorgeous.
Oh, thank you.
Now, were they originally in the magazine?
They were, yes. Oh, okay. These are recipes that came from the best spring issues over the course of our 15 years of publishing.
Okay, so they were retested and everything, but...
Oh, my goodness, tested and retested. I think we test a minimum of 3 times with every recipe, and then we cross-test after that. So we really, we do like to think that our recipes come with a guarantee of success.
There you go. Well, I'm much more of an amateur cook than Anne is. And so I always like to ask somebody who produces a new cookbook, how do you expect people would use it? I mean, would they come home from the store with something and then open the index and say, now I'm going to figure out what I'm going to cook? Or is there a different approach that you had in mind when you put the book together?
You know, I think people do that both ways. I often find that I have the most fun if I go to the farmer's market or my, you know, I get my CSA delivery. And I'm really just looking for inspiration in terms of what to do with all these great ingredients. But then there's also that other side of me who really wants to sit down on the weekend and plan out my week so that I have a pretty good sense of what I'm going to need to prepare which dishes on which night. That tends to be more of a fantasy than a reality, but I do sometimes start out that way. And I think, you know, with this book, you can take either approach and you'll come out happier for it.
So in the second approach, you would probably say, well, let me think about the season.
Exactly, exactly. So. And the week and, you know, and what's growing around you as well.
Well, you know, some of these things, they're arresting some of these recipes here.
The what?
They're arresting. I keep getting... staring at these recipes instead of conducting the interview.
I have that same problem sometimes. I get lost in the food photography around here, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, I mean, the photography is really great.
Thank you.
How about orzo with shiitakes, caramelized onions and spinach, tiny pasta with zucchini and peppers. Oh, here, Spanish braised spinach with chickpeas. Oh, God, it's so good.
Oh, my. Okay, I'm hooked now. I think we have to go and cook.
I think so.
I marked the risotto with peas, mint, and lemon.
Uh-huh.
That's just right up my alley. I don't know. There's something really delicious about that.
Oh, yes. Now, tell us, in addition to the recipes, here's another one I want right now. Is
did you see the baked fettuccine and asparagus with lemon, pine nuts, and mascarpone?
Oh, wow.
Oh.
And here's Thai beef salad with mint and cilantro. You were talking about mint and cilantro.
Actually, pretty soon we're going to be looking for a recipe for what to do with chicken breasts.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
Chicken breasts.
Because that's for dinner tonight. So we hope there's something really inspiring in here we can do with chicken breasts.
Ooh, let's see what we can find. I think everybody must have chicken breasts in their refrigerator right now.
Yeah, I think there's a cookbook about what to do with chicken breasts.
More than one, I'm sure.
Yeah. Now, tell us about, in addition to the recipes that are wonderful, tell us about some of the added-on features in the back of the book with your tips on freezing.
Sure.
And tell us about those.
Sure. Actually, the back of the book, it opens with a vegetable guide, and I have already found this very useful. It kind of, begins with asparagus and takes you through tomatoes and really includes everything from, you know, different ways to prepare vegetables, different ways to store them, ideas for simple preparations that are less complicated than actual recipes, but really kind of inspired in terms of new ideas, new things to do, information about how they grow. There's one of my favorite little images in the book is actually in asparagus. I don't know if
I'm just
ever
looking right at it. Yeah,
you can actually see the asparagus, what it looks like in the ground, which is really kind of a funny thing if you've never seen it before. They just pop right up like they're, you know, little soldiers standing at attention.
Yeah, but you know, I never got more than two spears on my asparagus.
I find them very hard to grow too.
Yeah,
I have to admit we
got a lot of ferns, but not much asparagus.
Yes, and zucchini takes off, and you know, chives. That's the other thing I can always grow, but asparagus is definitely a hard one.
And
so I think this is a really good resource for, you know, whether you're shopping at the farmer's market or pulling things from your backyard, whatever. There's lots of great ideas here.
Yeah, and then you say, like, fennel, okay. I guess fennel is much more familiar than it used to be. There was a time nobody
so
had
true,
it much.
Yes.
But here you have, in addition to all about fennel, you have how to trim and cut it, and you show the different cuts.
Exactly.
I think that's
really useful, too. I think, you know, for people who are kind of maybe coming to fennel for the first time and not even sure what part of it to use, and actually learning here that you can use all of it for the most part.
You do then, anything about, what is it, the, what was it, the lemongrass? Because I never could figure out what you cut away in the lemongrass.
Not in here, but in an upcoming issue, we do have some advice on that. That's one of them. We have a new column in the magazine. It's called Try This, and it's sort of that idea of, you know, ingredients that you walk by in the grocery store all the time because you just don't know quite what to do with them, so you don't necessarily pick it up and buy it. And we're kind of saying, stop. Really, this ingredient is worth your discovery. Bring it home, and we'll walk you through a recipe and kind of teach you how to use it.
Well, we can't do lemongrass anymore because we had a big tree and somebody assassinated it.
Well, I got tired of bringing it in and throwing it out.
Somebody who shall be nameless committed what I call lemongrassicide.
Oh, are you married to her?
And she's on the program. She's on the program with me right now, and I haven't decided what kind of life sentence she should have yet, but probably a life sentence without any lemongrass.
I'm so sorry, Anne.
Well, I mean, it always looked so unhappy in the house anyhow, you know, it's kind of quirky. It's like
I know, they are sort of scraggly looking, yes.
Well, this got really big. I mean, it was really rather enormous.
So maybe it had to go.
I would have been happy to bring it in, but Anne decided it should either was sort of kill or cure. If you can't survive the winter, you can't be in our lives. And sure enough, the poor little thing shriveled up at the first sight of snow.
Oh.
it was off to the races.
Yeah, I kind of consider it. I think of them as a tropical ingredient, definitely.
Okay. Laurie, tell us, you just moved not only from Los Angeles to Connecticut, but moved from Bon Appetit, where you had worked for a number of years, to this particular magazine. That's a big shift for you.
It was.
Yeah. But it's a wonderful magazine you're working for now. Tell us about that. I mean, like, where did it get started and so forth?
Sure. I've been a fan of fine cooking for a very long time. I've just kind of always been amazed at how it's, there's so much authority in this magazine, and one of the things that appealed to me about this opportunity was to really kind of come to the magazine and let people know more about it. It was there, and it's been actually out there for 15 years, but it was always very quiet about all the things that it did so well, these triple-tested recipes, these incredible contributors that they had. And from my perspective, there was kind of a window in the marketplace, a window of opportunity that was for a magazine that was really just about cooking, that wasn't so much about restaurants and chefs and celebrities,
parties, no travel.
Really, we're just kind of reaching out to the cook, who's wherever that person is, you know, whether they're novices or they're really expert cooks. There's something here that's going to inspire them. Every issue, there's just going to be that connection with the cook and teaching them new things, really, you know, kind of giving them the tools that they need to get to be an even better cook. And for me, that was the part that I couldn't resist. It was a chance to kind of try my hand at this and come up with a magazine that really spoke to the cook in a way that nobody else out there was.
So. Well, it does do that. And now how about a website?
Yes, we do. We're at finecooking.com, and interestingly enough, we just redesigned and relaunched the website as well. So we have a website, and we have special issues, and we actually have cookbooks, too. So we're an all-purpose cooking brand, as it were.
Well, I really can't say enough good things about this book. I'm looking at Fine Cooking Fresh, just a beautiful book with absolutely fascinating recipes in it.
And now we must
go
find a recipe for chicken.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
We'll have to find you one. fun.
So goodbye for now, so that we have a chance to go do that.
Okay.
Yeah, Laurie, you've been such a good sport with this.
Oh, hello.
I'm just saying goodbye.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so
We've
much for having me.
We've had such a good time with you. Of course, I kept wanting to chat, and Peter's more on task. Anyhow, keep us posted. Let's do it again.
Oh, it would be fun.
Yeah, let us know if you have anything to change or upcoming or exciting about the magazine, and we'll go for it.
Thanks, Anne. It was really nice to talk to you, Peter.
Oh, Laurie, thank you. Bye.
Okay, talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Well, we have a variety of life-changing events in our life, or on the menu's life, but one of them that certainly has made a big difference in my Peter's life is the Grill Daddy, which we will explain to you because we're going to talk about its creator, Michael Wales. Hi, Michael. Welcome to On the Menu.
How are you? Thanks for having me.
Fine. Now, I guess we have a lot to cover here. We need to know, like, what did you do before? How did you discover this? How did you market it? What it does? How to use it?
We always ask 8 questions at once. I never understand how you can ask 8 questions at once and then expect Michael to remember what they all are.
That's all right.
Let me first of all be brutally honest and say that I'm a really lazy grill cleaner. I mean, I wait till the grill on my Weber charcoal grill is really grungy before I try to clean it. And it's just laziness, I think, is the reason for that. And I think, well, it can wait one more time before I clean it. But it also is because you sort of really lack convenient tool to be able to do that. Now, Michael, you invented one. How come?
Well, I, like many people, are just frustrated. I was frustrated with ordinary grill cleaning brushes. Nothing worked. And there's nothing I hate more than a dirty grill. I hate going out and putting a steak or fish or something on a grill that's dirty.
Okay, so you're really passionate about making sure it's clean, whereas I'm the opposite. I'm not so passionate. I know the fire will kill everything, and it sort of adds to the flavor.
Rabbit.
It may not be the flavor you want, though. That's hard to control
flavor.
That flavor.
Yeah, okay, three-week-old fish.
So you started out being a grill cleanliness fanatic.
Yep. I would hate to go to somebody else's house who had a dirty grill. You know, it's like people that you go to people's houses and you know their house is going to be dirty, you know? Well,
yeah.
I mean, and you have that same recall when it comes to the grill. At any rate, I never would want to serve food on a dirty grill to guests, you know, any more than you would cook with a dirty pan, you know? I just started, well, first of all,
What was your day job before?
Well, my background really is in coming up with new products. I mean, that's what I always did. I had another company, you know, that I started back in the 70s. Actually, I invented these little water-saving shower heads back during the first oil embargo, and I had a company, it was called Resources Conservation. And I invented all these little conservation products. I realized that conservation had a much better payback than solar energy does, you know, when you look at the cost. Anyway, I'll keep that story short.
So you're a professional inventor.
Yeah, I really realized that I became a pretty good new product inventor. And so I started this company and I started, you know, creating new products. And every year I would come out with something new and I would take it to retail. And I sold that company and I was sitting around wondering what I'm going to do with myself. And I started thinking about my next product, and that was the Grill Daddy.
Okay, so explain the Grill Daddy now.
Well, I bought all these different brushes and I'm trying to get them to work and nothing's really working. So it finally dawned on me, you know what, why don't I, you know, use water, because if I use it on the hot grill, it'll generate steam. And there's nothing better than steam to break things down.
Right, now let's back up a second, because in my laziness, when I finally got around to cleaning the grill, the dilemma was always, would I use a Brillo pad? And in that case, I'd have to use a lot of water to make sure that all got removed.
Right.
And you say, absolutely no detergent, no soap product of any kind anywhere near my Grill Daddy.
Right.
What I'm doing is I'm using pure water so that it's all nice and clean, and I'm using the fact that the grill's already hot. So take it from there.
Right. So what I'd figured out is, you know, the grill's already hot, so you can use the heat of the grill to generate the steam, and all you need is a great delivery mechanism. You need something that is gives you leverage, something that keeps your hands away from the heat, and something that does it in a way so that the water distribution is even and it's measured, and that it, you know, it's really effective and it makes the task go quickly. So I took all those parameters and came up with the Grill Daddy.
Right, so the Grill Daddy, for those of you who have a previous generation unsatisfactory grill cleaner, there's a square pad with lots and lots of wire teeth on it. And then there's a funny little sort of a fringe on the end that you can use presumably for tighter corners on the grill.
Well, also areas where it's really burned on bad.
Okay,
so what
right.
I did was I have the conventional main brush head, and that's where the water comes out of.
Okay,
and
right.
And the water comes out, there's a device inside the Grill Daddy that measures the amount of water that comes out at any one time, so it all just doesn't, you know, dump out at once.
Right. So,
and it's
so
really just it's air pressure that moves the water through the Grill Daddy. There's a patented little valve that lets air in, but it won't let water out. And when you turn the little valve to the on position, it opens up the Grill Daddy, you know, to the air, and then the air pressure just pushes it out.
Now, are you an engineer?
No, not really. I'm just a practical guy that learned all that stuff because I used to have a factory where we made everything, and I dealt with engineers all day, and you know, I have a working knowledge of engineering.
So this rather ferocious looking tool, you fill it with cold water at one end,
right?
Then you approach your grill, which you've heated during the warm up of the gas grill or the charcoal grill, so the surface of the grill is super hot. So then you approach your grill with your Grill Daddy in hand, and you scrub away, and steam rises, and everything becomes clean. The nasty gritty stuff all falls into the grill flames and is consumed.
Right. Let me tell you how the process. There's a little science at work here.
Okay.
So what happens is the holes in the main brush they're large holes because we want large water drop. We wouldn't want a mist or anything because when you use it on a hot grill, a mist would evaporate before it had a chance to do anything.
Okay.
So, and the water comes out of the brush head while it's on the grill. It doesn't spray out in front of it or anything like that.
Right.
So what happens is that these large water droplets soak into the burned-on mess.
Oh.
And what happens is that it penetrates this burned-on mess, and then the heat of the grill causes the water to start to boil, and when that happens, the water churns, and it starts to break up all the burned-on residue. And then when the steam escapes, so that's the science that's going on. And the brush really just moves it out of the way.
I see.
And the scraper brush that's attached to the scraper, those bristles are twice as thick as the main brush head bristles are. And the reason for that is it's extra stiff so that if you have an area where, you know, the area where you might use it all the time, that will break up anything that manages to stay on. And also that gets ionies in between the grill grates.
That's brilliant. How long did it take you to set this through?
Well, you know, I probably played around with it. It took me a year to really get it all going. And then, you know, after I came up with a functioning model, then we had to make it look right and then hold the right amount of water. And then I also came up with two sizes. And I came up, like, the large Grill Daddy is actually designed, it's, you know, first of all, the handles are ergonomic, so they're comfortable. And the angle of the engagement of the main brush head on the grill surface is actually the optimum angle to achieve the maximum amount of leverage with the least amount of effort. And also, at the same time, it keeps your hands safely away from the heat and, you know, protects your hands from the heat of the grill. So all those things were taken into consideration when we came up with the finished product.
Well, this is kind of indispensable. If you're into a clean grill, this is absolutely indispensable. So, Michael, I think the next thing we need to do before we say goodbye is to just make sure that listeners know how to get one.
Well, you can go to www.buygrilldaddy.com, and you can also call an 800 number, and I will get that for you right now. But the other thing to think about also is that I have two sizes, and I have one for large grills for the professional. I mean, a lot of restaurants even use the large one. And then the other smaller, the big one's called the Grill Daddy Pro, and the little one is for small grills, camping, picnics, and tailgating. And they're also both designed, you know, not to douse a charcoal fire. And the other thing to think about, too, is that any excess water evaporates, so it won't harm, you know, any internal, mechanisms or anything on a gas grill. But the 800 number for the Grill Daddy is 800-419-7183.
Well, this is just a wonderful story.
Yeah, you've got another winner, I think, Michael.
You'll have to call us and let us know when you come up with something new. Are you working on a new product now?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that I do have, what I've done is, you know, we have, just to back up, you know, both, all the brushes on the Grill Daddies, both of them are designed to be put in the dishwasher. But one little point I want to make is that the steam and the hot water liquefy grease, so the grease drains away. And so the nice thing about the Grill Daddy is when you're done using it, the brush is clean because, you know, the water coming through the bristles actually clean off the bristles and then the grease drains away. But I do have replacement brushes, but you'll get a whole season out of the Grill Daddy brushes. They're really made to last. But what I have come out with was I have a bunch of accessories that will more specifically adapt to maybe a certain grill type. And I'll be coming out with those in the future.
Well, you're just by way of being a bit of a genius for the outdoor chef, and we're so glad that we came across Grill Daddy, and we're so glad that we have one, and we certainly thank you for joining us today.
Yeah,
great,
Michael,
thank you.
Great to meet you. You're fascinating.
Well, thank you very much, and I really enjoyed talking to both of you.
Well, thank you. Bye, Michael.
Alrighty, take care.
Thank you, bye. Well, I guess that does it for this week.
Hmm? Another action-packed On the Menu program. We hope you enjoyed it, and you'll tune in and join us same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.